Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure to be joined by Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory published in softcover by the Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. Ed, we have, first of all, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you.
We have been tracing a tortuous journey, beginning with the political connections of Tulane University and New Orleans through the medical career and political career of Alton Ochsner, an individual whose milieu heavily overlaps that involved with the New Orleans connections to the Kennedy assassination and in turn the national security establishment and the ultra-right wing. And we have come across one of his colleagues and protégés, Dr. Mary Sherman, a prominent cancer researcher, one of the foremost names in American medicine, although sadly unrecognized for that, or largely unrecognized. And she, as it turns out, appears to have been involved in an underground medical laboratory with David Ferry, the initial focus of Jim Garrison's investigation. And they were working on injecting, apparently working on injecting, no, well, the project was certainly working on injecting mice with monkey viruses in order to produce cancer. Dr. Mary Sherman was murdered under very strange circumstances just before the Warren Commission came to New Orleans. And in our last segment, we examined the possibility that among the focal points of research being done in this underground laboratory was the contamination of the polio vaccine with cancer-causing monkey viruses, specifically the SV40. You've theorized that a linear particle accelerator may have been used to mutate those viruses in order to find a benign strain, and that this, in turn, appears to have spawned many of the recombinant DNA and genetic engineering experiments, many of which, or many of the primary experiments in which, were devoted to the SV40 virus.
That's a great summary of a very complex storyline.
Well, it's only taken us just over 2.5 hours to get through the previous information. In addition to your discovery of what is quite literally an epidemic of soft tissue cancers, possibly in connection with the contamination of the polio vaccine by apparently cancer-causing monkey viruses, there are some indications that perhaps that contamination, or perhaps the research connected with this underground laboratory, may have inadvertently or inadvertently led to the development of AIDS. You discuss a projection by a medical expert that monkey viruses might infect humans and alter their pathogenesis. Can you explain what that means for us?
Sure. humans are capable of getting viruses from other animals. For example, if a dog who has rabies bites a person, the person can get rabies. That process of animal-to-man transference of the disease through the virus is called zoonosis, and it's a relatively well-established point in medicine. There are a number of monkey viruses which already are known and identified to be in the human blood supply as part of that body of medical literature. Malaria is considered to be a monkey virus which is in the human blood supply. The one that's received the most publicity recently is the Ebola virus from Africa. Personally, they've never proven that's from a monkey, but they were experimenting with it in monkeys here in the United States for the last 20 years, and therefore it's considered to be a monkey virus. Mm-hmm. But they haven't found it in the wild in a monkey yet, so I think it's an interesting point. And thirdly, there's a cousin of the AIDS virus, which is called SIV, or in the monkey version, it's called HIV-2 in the human version, which is considered to be a monkey virus in the human blood supply. Now, the change in the pathogenesis is very interesting because it brings up a point that's really on the leading edge of the AIDS debate right now, and that is, does the virus change because it's reacting to different stimuli in the human blood supply than it would have in the monkey blood supply? In other words, does its presence in the human blood supply accelerate its evolution and mutation? That is one path of thought. The other path of thought, as it relates back to HIV-1, which is the AIDS virus, is that thing was mutated before it became AIDS. and that mutation, the actual cause of that mutation, is the one disclaimer sentence you run in all the articles. Nobody quite knows how that mutation happened.
Before we get into how that might have happened and some of the viruses apparently associated with AIDS, in the 1960s, when you were a student, there were rumors going around, perhaps more than that, of a graduate student or two at Tulane University who was experiencing or who had experienced total collapses of the immune system, and also a story of a patient who had experienced something similar to that. Can you fill us in on that?
The student was not at Tulane. The student I referred to was at Jesuit High School.
Okay.
When I was there, but he was a homosexual, and over the course of one summer, had a rare type of leukemia flare up and completely consumed him, and over the summer, and he died as a result of it. And it was explained to me at the time in 1969 that it was a bloodborne disease which was being passed through homosexual circles in New Orleans, and that was 13 years before the AIDS situation was announced in the press. I thought that 13-year delay in informing the public of the presence of a sexually transmitted lethal form of leukemia was irresponsible from the press's point of view. Secondly, there was a case which I was told in 1969 was in New Orleans about a young black boy who was 15 years old from St. Louis who had been transferred down to New Orleans for treatment, and they gave him every antibiotic in the book and nothing worked, and eventually his immune system just collapsed, and when they went through his clinical stuff, he had Kaposi's sarcoma, he had all these things that are frequently clinically associated with AIDS. And then in 1988, the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, published an article which said that they had run a serology test on him and proven him to be an AIDS case. When I read that article, I was very interested to find that three of the nine doctors who signed it were from Tulane, but there was no mention of either Tulane or New Orleans in the article. Subsequently, I think they've done genetic testing on that and come to the conclusion that that particular case was not HIV-1. But those were two things that I was familiar with from the 60s, which indicated that the presence of a slow-wasting form of leukemia, which was being sexually transmitted, was known in the 1960s and was not communicated to the public. And I think that's a real tragedy.
Now, you were discussing, back to a previous line of inquiry, the possibility of HIV, the apparent cause of AIDS, if there's some to dispute that, being somehow descended from a monkey virus. Could you tell us about that and also discuss whether perhaps that was an accident, perhaps it was deliberate, and what the information in each case it consists of?
Okay. First of all, it is the opinion of the mainstream scientific establishment in this country, from Max Essex at Harvard University to Gerald Myers at Los Alamos Laboratories and to everybody else in those circles, that HIV-1 is descended from SIV, which is the simian immunodeficiency virus, and therefore AIDS is a mutation of a monkey virus. HIV-1, which causes AIDS, is a mutation of a monkey virus. There are people, for anything you can say in AIDS, there are people that will disagree with it and argue with it. But what I'm saying here is that the people who have access to the most expensive equipment and have the biggest pedigrees and all that stuff that relates in that context all say it's a mutated monkey virus.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've discussed in a documentary called AIDS Epidemic or Weapon of War the possibility that genetic engineering may have been involved in the creation of AIDS, and that perhaps it may have been deliberate. One of the things that you discuss in your book is the evidence that perhaps, and obviously, again, anything dealing with AIDS is going to be hotly disputed, but information indicating that the AIDS virus falls well outside what you call the envelope of nature, unquote.
Mm-hmm. The question of whether it's natural or unnatural is a different question than whether it was deliberate or accidental. But let me address it as the first question. Anytime a live entity, and we're calling a virus a live entity because it reproduces, anytime a live entity reproduces, it never makes a perfect copy of itself. There's some variation, and they are able to measure that genetic variation, and that is called the intrinsic error frequency rate. Okay? Now, for everything they have ever measured that on, if you put it on a graph, they have a high and a low. Okay? That is our understanding of the intrinsic error frequency of nature. Okay? When they ran those same tests on HIV-1, they discovered that every time it made a copy of itself, it made a considerably different copy of itself. And when they measured that error frequency rate and put it on the graph, it was outside of every other thing they'd ever looked at. Now, and this is Los Alamos Labs doing this, right? When you have that situation, you only have two choices. You either have to redefine nature in order to include HIV-1, or you have to say it's unnatural. And that's the situation on that. I mean, you either redefine nature or you call it unnatural.
Now, you've also theorized the possibility that the creation of AIDS may have been connected with this underground medical laboratory, perhaps accidentally or perhaps deliberately.
Well, the other point that comes in with the deliberate thing is as they've tried to find the ancestors of AIDS,
right,
and they find this, there's a big gap. I mean, there's this huge gap, and there's no immediate ancestors. Now, the sudden appearance of a bizarre virus, which is behaving differently than every other known virus, and with no identifiable ancestors, is a very strong suggestion that something very dramatic, I mean, some intervention happened to this thing to suddenly create a massive mutation in it. And that, as far as I'm concerned, is the argument that is extremely suspicious, and when you read all the scientific articles on AIDS and they use words like mysterious and baffling and puzzling and all this stuff, that's what they're talking about. They're saying this thing is a mutated monkey virus and we can't find a trail on it, and it looks like it was a sudden mutation. And when does it look like it happened? And as they run the graphs back and they do the genetic sequencing and they pull it back, all the numbers come in at the early 60s, 1960, 1961, right in maybe 63. Latest possibility, 1968. Okay, but it's definitely 1960s.
So it's this is when this mutation took place. And again, the dramatic nature of the mutation, the number of genes that have mutated, defies a proper tracing of its viral ancestors, so to speak.
That's right. And 1964 is when Mary Sherman died, and when I believe the linear particle accelerator was being used to mutate the monkey viruses to develop a vaccine to try to prevent the cancer epidemic that we're currently experiencing.
One of the possibilities that occurs to me is, obviously, given the national security connections that surround this investigation and the vast majority of the people involved in it, I wonder whether perhaps a search for a benign virus to counteract the contamination of the polio virus by the SV40 may have also come up with a mutation that elements of the national security establishment found could be quite useful in order to dispose of unwanted people.
Well, you couldn't stop them from doing it once they had it. I mean, that's the first point. If they wanted to use it, they could.
And we should also note that the National Cancer Institute's Molecular Oncology Laboratory, NAFOR-Dietrich, where Dr. Gerone originally came from, or at least he went to the Delta Primate Center from there, that has figured prominently in AIDS research. We don't have time to trace the lineage in this broadcast, but the involvement of Litton, of Bionetics Research Systems Incorporated, eventually becoming Litton Bionetics, with the National Cancer Institute's Viral Cancer Research Program, whose cell culture laboratory was maintained at the Oakland Naval Biosciences Lab by Drs. Alfred Hellman and Jack Gruber, both longtime veterans of Fort Detrick. Later, Litton Bionetics handles the NCI's Molecular Oncology Lab, NAFOR-Dietrich, Robert Gallo is working for them. So is Jack Gruber. Of course, Gallo eventually becomes Mr. AIDS researcher, so to speak, in this country. And 3 months after he makes the announcement with Margaret Heckler, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, that they, what used to be called the LTV3, or was it HTV3?
It's HTLV3.
HTLV3.
The human T-cell
lymphoma virus.
Yeah.
The initial terminology for what we now call HIV.
Mm-hmm.
The files of the National Cancer Institute were classified top secret in a National Security Agency directive, all of which proves nothing. But Richard Nixon's war on cancer, his conversion of Fort Detrick to, quote, civilian, unquote, use, although it's still shares that facility with the Army's Institute of Infectious Diseases, raises some very interesting questions. And again, in a long documentary I've done, RFA-16, AIDS Epidemic or Weapon of War, I've explored the possibility that AIDS might not be a natural disease. And indeed, that's something that you consider very carefully in your book.
As you were talking, I just remembered I wanted to emphasize one point, that this laboratory we're investigating does not appear to have been connected officially with either Tulane University or Ochsner Clinic, even though some of the people connected to it were connected to both of those institutions. This appears to be a separate activity.
Right. I would also note, too, that we cannot prove necessarily that the development of AIDS came from there. One point I would like to make, though, quoting from your book, you evaluate the possibility that AIDS was deliberately created and evaluate the criteria that would have been necessary for such an institution. And you write on page 63, actually, just about every medical school and government research facility could muster the above requirements if directed to do so. Therefore, the next ingredient is critical because it is hard to find in combination with the above resources. You must have an environment which is tolerant of, quote, wild card, unquote, experiments. So the question is not only who would do such a thing, but also who would allow researchers to play genetic roulette by irradiating monkey viruses in their facility. It would not be surprising if nobody wanted it done in their facility due to the enormous risks and possible repercussions. So if there was a reason compelling enough to warrant such risky experiments, it would not be surprising to find the whole effort being conducted in secret, yes, in an underground medical laboratory. Moving on to opportunity. Any potential creator of HIV would have had to have all of the above capabilities operating within the time frame determined by the scientists, before 1969 and most likely in the late 1950s or early 1960s. Finally, motive. Someone has to have a compelling reason to do a project of this scale, to take the time, to spend the money, to organize the resources, and to do it all in secret. What reason could justify such effort and risks? Would a desperate attempt to find a cure for cancer explain it if they were using radical techniques which would not have been accepted in a traditional research environment? Or perhaps it could be explained by a conscious desire to develop a biological weapon to rid the world of politically undesirable people. So let me ask a hypothetical question. If we knew about an underground medical laboratory that had the capability, opportunity, and motives outlined above, what should we do about it? Should we say that's irrelevant, or didn't every town have a group of political extremists experimenting with monkey viruses in an underground medical laboratory, unquote? Or should we say, who were these people and what were they really doing? My main point is, there was such an underground medical laboratory, and between the technician who ran it and the doctor involved, they had all the capabilities, opportunities, and motives discussed above. Well said, Ed, and I think the importance of your book could not be exaggerated. Your research, however, has not stopped with what you have published in this volume. You've learned some more things since you published Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus.
Yes, we have, and the most dramatic is I never thought we were going to be able to find the actual accelerator, I mean, to prove where it was, and we have had some sources come forward who have given us information where we now know where the accelerator was. We know that it existed. We know that it was on U.S. government property. We know that it was at a facility which was associated with some of the people we've been discussing and was extremely in close proximity to virtually everybody in the loop. And we are in the process of trying to document that with the type of documentation that everybody would want to see, such as official records from government files. et cetera, such as they did when they documented the plutonium experiments. But I no longer think of the accelerator as a theory or a conjecture. We know it was there. We know who operated it, and it was being operated on U.S. government property. The questions that come up is who paid for it, who secured the location for it to be operated on, and who is it that took Mary Sherman's body off of U.S. government property and brought it back to her apartment in order to avoid the scrutiny that that incident would have brought on that facility.
One point that perhaps we should make, too, I certainly don't, and you don't in your book, cast any aspersions whatsoever on Mary Sherman. She was not, there's no indication whatsoever she was involved in any sort of malfeasance, but was in all probability undertaking this clandestine research in good faith to try to stave off the soft, something like the soft tissue cancer epidemic, which is now afflicting the United States.
She was trying to prevent the epidemic. She was working on a vaccine. I certainly don't think the decision to keep this research secret was hers. In fact, one of the questions that I'm attempting to bring up to the relevant parties is, would you please explain what the national security issue was that required this to be secret? Because it appears to me that they were not protecting something that should have been defined as a national security problem. They were simply protecting the reputation of certain political people who were involved in the decisions. In other words, they were hiding a mistake from the American people. They were not developing something that should have been classified as a national secret.
And also, Bay Area researcher Richard Hatch wrote a very fine article about the National Cancer Institute's viral cancer research program in Covert Action. It used to be called Covert Action Information Bulletin, issue number 39. Now it's called Covert Action Quarterly. I think that interested listeners should attempt to get a hold of that, or should get a hold of that article, for some of the background on some of the national security connections between the NCI's VCR, or some of the national security connections to the NCI's VCR. There may very well have been, and there certainly appears to have been, a piggybacking of biological warfare research onto the National Cancer Institute's viral cancer research program.
May I add one thought here?
Sure.
As we look at the location of the accelerator in New Orleans, something becomes very obvious to us, and that is that the accelerator was located several blocks from Lee Harvey Oswald's apartment, and that he was equipped with all the equipment that he would need to be equipped with in order to conduct professional-level espionage on it by taking long-distance night photography.
Huh.
The possibility must be considered that Oswald's assignment when he was sent to New Orleans was to conduct espionage on this facility. That, of course, raises two very specific questions. One is, who is he working for? And question two is, who is he working against?
Mm-hmm.
And that raises another issue which you have referred to several times in this, and that is the Warren Commission. The Warren Commission investigation began the day Mary Sherman died. We also have to consider that the incident which happened with the accelerator was a deliberate act of sabotage intended to attract the attention of the Warren Commission to this facility, because the FBI had come to the same facility the Monday following JFK's assassination looking for information on Lee Harvey Oswald or A.J. Heidel. It was on the roster for the Warren Commission to investigate. And had Mary Sherman or Dr. Alton Ochsner been blown up at this facility with the Warren Commission poised to investigate it anyway, and had they come in and found this machine with the monkey viruses and everything else, and had they figured out what was going on in here, the entire results of the Warren Commission investigation would have been different. And that's why it was so important to get Mary Sherman's body out of there and create this lesbian slashing story for her back at her apartment.
I wonder, too, whether perhaps given the connections that you've just outlined and given the potential that you've just discussed, whether perhaps Mary Sherman, to all appearances being a woman of high integrity and great intelligence, might have blown the whistle, whether she, hey, wait a minute, I know this guy, David Ferry, et cetera, that perhaps her, quote, accident, unquote, was not an accident and intended to keep her from blowing the whistle.
That is a position that a lot of researchers have taken on this thing. My personal position on it is that this is bigger than all that. This is, they sabotaged the machine, and it happened to blow up Mary Sherman. If the machine, if the 5 million volt blast of electricity that came out of the machine had taken off Dr. Alton Ochsner's right arm,
mm-hmm.
it would have been even more successful from the saboteur's purpose. Whoever sabotaged that machine knew the association between Oswald and that facility, and that's why they were trying to pull the Warren Commission into it.
Ed, we're almost out of time here. You've set forth a fascinating evidentiary tributary connecting the milieu of the assassination of President Kennedy to an underground viral cancer research laboratory, quite possibly involving an epidemic of soft tissue cancers caused by the contamination of the polio vaccine by cancer-causing monkey viruses, quite possibly also leading to the deliberate or accidental creation of AIDS. The book is Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory by Ed Haslam. Ed, people are going to want to know how to get a hold of this book. First, I'm going to read the address for Wordsworth Publishers. Wordsworth Publishers, 7200 Montgomery, number 280, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87109. Once again, it's Wordsworth, 7200 Montgomery, number 280, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87109. How else can they contact Wordsworth to get a hold of this book?
You can pick up your telephone right now and dial 1-800-MONKEY-X. That will go to a fulfillment center, which is staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Put it on your credit card, and they will mail it to whatever address you give them.
1-800-MONKEY-X. Do you know what that is in numbers off the top of your head?
No, I used to.
Okay. So dial 1-800-MONKEY-X.
Yeah, M-O-N-K-E-Y-X.
Okay, 1-800-MONKEY-X, and you can order this fascinating and vitally important Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, a story of an underground medical laboratory by Ed Haslam. Ed, it's been a fascinating 3 hours, and on behalf of the people affected by the events discussed in your book, and on behalf of the American people, I want to thank you for a fascinating and courageous and heroic effort in pursuing this line of work.
You're welcome.
Okay, we have been visiting with Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory, softcover, Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. Ed, thanks so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, so long.